This is RSVNB Update, episode 599, recorded Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. Sliske's Endgame, Elder Ex Machina. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us once again for RSVNB Update. As we approach the Christmas season, you guys might be listening to this on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, maybe before if we get it out ahead of time, but that's putting the cart before the horse here. This week, of course, we'll be discussing Sliske's Endgame. To do this, I have two of the questing all-stars of RSVNB Update and former co-hosts Sirion and Colton. Welcome back, you two.
Greetings. Hey, thanks,
Shane. So I assume you guys are thoroughly rested from this quest and ready to render judgment on perhaps the most hyped update ever. I think that would be a good way of describing it. But yeah. So Sliske's Endgame discussion ahead, and that means quest week, spoilers ahead. So if you don't want to hear what happened in the quest or you haven't done it yet, then you should perhaps... forego listening to this episode of RSVNB Update or fast forward at about an hour, which we
proceed
much rather
with caution.
Exactly. So Sliske's Endgame, we ended this quest line after almost 4 years. We started in early 2013. So that's relatively short considering Plague's End was a decade. And we had relative progress along the way. It wasn't as if we were left hung to dry because developers left after certain quests or anything like that. It progressed, and we slowly but surely revealed more about what was happening and got to the point where we were at with Endgame. So I guess before we go too far into Endgame itself, was it worth the wait?
Yeah, I'd say so. If you're comparing it to a quest series like the ElfQuest series, which was it over 10 years or was it just 10 years?
No, it was over 10 years.
Okay. Well, I think
if
you compare 4 years to 10 years, I think it was fairly well. It was dealt with pretty carefully in how quickly they went through it. And I think they did a fairly efficient job of it. I mean, is it my favorite quest series? Maybe not exactly, but I don't think they did any injustice in the speed at which they put out those quests.
All right. How about you, Sirion?
Well, I mean, you always want things to move forward, but in this particular case, we got lots of like intermediate quests on the way that were absolutely brilliant on their own. Like we got Fate of the Gods, Chisel of Ma. Those
Dishonor
were amazing
among
quests. Yeah, well, that one maybe not that much.
Oh, really? I like Dishonored Among Thieves.
Same.
But, we got, like, lots of quests on the way that were pretty, pretty good. So, this was a quest line where, like, there were some gaps in between, but generally there was some momentum behind it. Maybe not as much as, say, like, the Void Knights thing they did, like, a few years ago, where they just released everything in a year. But... I definitely did not feel like the quest line was dead at any point, like the elf line or the dwarf storyline, for example.
All right. And requirements for this, there were no skilling requirements, just the skilling requirements from behind previous quests, and all the previous quests you had to have completed were Children of Ma, Nomad's Elegy, Kindred Spirits, Hero's Welcome, One of a Kind, and Death of Chivalry.
Basically every quest that has to do with anything important.
That's right, because Children of Ma filters down to all the other ones, Elegy and Kindred Spirits. Hero's Welcome. That was a head-scratcher quest, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Let's not go back to that.
We had Draz on the show for that one, and we enjoyed discussing that. Okay. One of a Kind?
Yeah, Carapac was in that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Wink, wink. And Death of Chivalry. So those are the requirements for this quest. And you start this quest in Drainer Village by speaking to Rilomia, who is, of course, the Sliske ambassador. And
So what happened when I logged in is that actually I got like a message.
Yes.
While I was at the bank still.
Yeah. And, you know, they haven't done that, I don't think, since Regicide. So that was definitely an interesting way of starting this quest. And I think that kind of signifies the significance of it is that if they bring you a leaflet telling you to start this quest, then, I mean, it's time to go. So
that
was
good. I
liked
that.
Yeah, it was a nice level of immersion. And then after that, you have to go deliver invites to a bunch of gods, Ceridoman, Armadil, Zamorak, Saren, and Zaros. But they say they don't know where Zaros is going to be found. So you deliver all those invites.
You forgot Itchy.
Just call it Itchy.
Itchy. All right.
Itchy.
Yeah. Or was it Death if you, in that quest? In Nomad's Elegy, because I was under the impression that would swap depending on what you did in Nomad's Elegy. So it was Ikler for you guys as well?
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, you know, Ikler, and you wonder why Ikler is there, right? But I don't know. Didn't really seem to play much of a role. Armadil is in the Armadil Tower. Anything that jumps out at you guys about speaking with Armadil, and you guys would like to state on the record here for the podcast and what Armadil had to say about the entire process?
I could. I thought, I don't know. I don't know if I should say what I want to say, but
feel free.
You know.
Feel free. I mean, we're discussing it, and it's going to be on the record. And, I mean, for such a big quest, I think everything should be out there.
Well, for those unaware, they made him gay. There you go.
And he had two husbands as well.
Yeah. So, polygamous to boot.
And, I mean, the question is, why does a god even need a husband? Or a wife, for
that
matter?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're assuming that they don't need that sort of companionship. I don't know, but regardless, it's not the presence of it that bothered me as much as how it seemed like a hey, look. It seemed almost virtue signaling.
Yep.
Like, I don't know, Jagex. You can do better than that.
We don't need that in RuneScape. I mean, if you want to do something about that, make a rehash of Romeo and Juliet, except. Have it be a Gilenorian something.
Sure.
And something.
Yeah, go ahead. I don't have anything inherently. I'm not trying to speak against it. I'm saying that it felt very
in your face
unnatural.
And not necessary.
Yeah. I mean, they were very particular about how he went about saying, "Well, my first husband was," and I just I don't know. That's all I'm going to say, because it really isn't a big deal to me. It was just kind of...
It was shocking nonetheless.
Yeah, I was...
I think it shocked
me aback, and I was like,
"What? It's just like, why put it in such a blunt way?"
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, they could have saved this for the Armadil quest, right?
Yeah,
still want the Armadil quest one day. I think that would have been a great thing to do. Leading
you
up.
And yes. Three other people. No,
I want the Abenak quest as well.
No, I think it would be neat. It'd be interesting to go at it from a take after this quest line.
There you go. I mean, look. Sesame Street is over, and Big Bird is still relevant, right?
Sure, yeah. Big Bird is still relevant.
Anyways, okay, so Armadil. What else did he say? I think he basically said that he felt that he was the only one who could effectively keep the stone safely because, you know, Ceridoman claims to be for the people of Gilenor, but Ceridoman will use the stone in a way that won't benefit them. He effectively called Ceridoman some elitist prick who was going to, you know, not use the stone in the right way. he's going to get the stone saying he's going to work for his followers, but at the end of the day, it's going to be all for him. And as a result, Armadale felt as though he should have been the primary competition towards Sarah Doman. And, you know, because of that, I actually liked Armadale's character more for doing this in this quest once he said that. So I was happy to hear Armadale say that. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I mean, he was the only one who I believe said that he wanted to. Though you could compare Armadale to, I don't know, people in like Lord of the Rings who wanted not to destroy the ring, but wanted to, you know, just tuck it away where no one could use it.
And that sort of thing is actually why I think if I was doing this over again, I would side with Armadale.
See, that's a reason I wouldn't side with Armadale.
Oh, because really?
In the end, they needed to destroy the ring, and thus I feel what happened at the end of this quest.
I wanted to hide the stone away.
See, I think the destruction was what was necessary.
All right, we'll get there. We'll get there in interesting circumstances.
There was one interesting thing you could tell. You could tell Armadale about the massacre that Zamorak did, or the experiments. Or was it?
Yes, I did that
on the Avian Sea, and that actually influences the storyline of the quest. At least it did in my occasion. Because can I move forward?
Yeah, please.
At some point in the labyrinth, like the person who won the first maze would choose another god to lose their entourage in the maze. And in my case, Armadale won the first maze. And then because of what you told him, made Zamorak lose his entourage.
That's what happened in mine as well.
That is something like that is something where your choices came back. But also, to be honest, this was the only instance where I strongly felt that my choice made a difference.
Okay.
In this quest. But all right. That was there, and I thought it was cool that in this huge dialogue tree with a god, like one, there was like lots of options, and one of those paths would lead to like this thing that would happen later in the quest. So, I don't know.
All right. Did you guys catch anything worthwhile of the discussion with Zamorak when you delivered the invite?
Nah.
Okay.
He didn't like me. He wouldn't tell me anything because he didn't like me.
Okay.
Let me check my notes. What did I say? Yeah, he played it pretty close to the chest.
Yeah, he wouldn't
play according to his philosophy, and that if we need to know more, then we should just look at his strength through chaos, blah, 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 yeah. blah.
So my guess is that if you like really sided with Zamorak during like Dishonor Amongst Thieves, he would be more.
See, I did. That's the thing is that during Dishonor Among Thieves. Yeah, I mean, when there were quests that involved both he and Zaras, I sided more with Zaras. But yeah, I don't know.
Not entirely sure how that works out.
No. And see, this is why we need the replayability, because the way we saw it, the way you and I saw it, is all canonical to our characters. But it would be very interesting to see what the other options are.
Well, will they allow us to do that once it is replayable?
I was under the impression.
Will it always be?
I was under the impression you will be able to see the other cutscenes and the other dialogue options in the replays.
Okay. So I was like, what they sort of like promised was like at the start of the quest, you get to choose like all your past choices, like not even in this quest, but you get to also like change choices you made in the Quiet Quest. So maybe you can change the choice you made in Dishonored Amongst Thieves or Fate of the Gods, that kind of stuff. And that way influence the way that all the characters interact with you in this quest.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be great to do. You know what we need to do? You guys know what we need to do? You guys might think this is a little bit nerdy, but we need to get together. Like, you know how you would have these book clubs at like Barnes & Noble or Chapters every Wednesday? So what you do is every Wednesday you get together and you all do a different playthrough of Sliske's Endgame, and then you discuss it.
Infinite possibilities. No.
No.
Probably at least like 30 or 40.
Exactly. So you'd be good for like upwards of a year.
Oh, I want to go through that maze once a week.
Okay, we'll get there. But first, Zaros and Saren's interaction in the Tower of Voices. Let's talk about that quickly.
Mm.
they were having an argument about the events of Children of Ma, believe it or not, and what Saren did. And I found that very interesting to see how they were having that argument like that and how it seemed like they were not even on the same side here. But for the sake of this quest and the sake of what was at stake, they agreed that they would go forward together, kind of presenting a united front. At least that's the sense that I got.
See, I got a different, maybe it was different dialogue, but okay. So what happened is that when I walked in, they were talking about basically how the stone should be dealt with. Zaros believed like it was imperative that the stone never fall into the hands of the elder gods. Yep. And Saren was hesitant to agree. Then eventually Saren actually swore to never aid, him. And that she wanted the stone in order to keep it away from abusers like Zaros. So maybe different dialogue from you guys, or I don't know.
There was like a lot of like Zaros and Saren always showed up like together, but they also never really worked together. Like at some point they were even like bickering over the stone for me. So this was like, it was very, very strange. Like, it seemed that they worked together, but weren't quite agreeing on what, how.
It was like the divorced couple who is trying to make things right for the kids.
Yes. That's very, that makes, I mean, they both knew that they had to basically supersede all of what Sliske wanted and to basically go above what his game's rules were and to somehow take the stone from him, but then to do what with the stone? They were not in agreement.
They were not in agreement, right? Okay, and then you teleport to the heart, which is where the quest truly begins, I think. But who shows up first, and what do we have to deal with before we get down there?
Gosh, why has he not dead yet?
We had to kill Nomad again.
Gosh.
Oh, but this must be surely the last time we have to kill Nomad.
Nope. And what this feels like it was the third or fourth time now. I mean,
oh no, more. Oh, well, maybe because Dominion Tower has kind of altered my sense of reality. Maybe that.
So you kill Nomad once during like Nomad's Requiem, then you kill him. Well, it's like five fights or something you do in like Nomad's Allergy, but you kill him once, and then you kill him twice again in this quest. So, I don't know, four times. We're now up to four times.
Yeah.
And then, like, the bazillion times you do it in a Dominion Tower. Yeah.
I don't know.
No more.
I mean, it seemed like that was just a card that was thrown out there just for the sake of it, in kind of with spirit of all the other quests.
It felt so...
It was forced.
It didn't feel right.
Before we continue, fight Nomad.
Whoop-de-doo.
That fight was easy as well. Why?
It was Nomad without all that makes him Nomad. So that was fun.
Yeah, that's a question mark. And I mean, you have to do this to get into the labyrinth, which is where we go next. But I mean, the Nomad fight really didn't add anything to it, I don't think.
I think it was sort of built to give you like a god kill, because Nomad like sort of goddy, like sort of a god because like world guardian powers, and that felt not elaborated and sort of like, oh yeah, in Nomad's Allergy he got some of your powers, so now he counts as a god or something. I don't know.
I don't know about that. All right, let's get into the labyrinth, which is, some people have joked that is actually what this quest should have truly been called, Sliske's Labyrinth, as was with last week's teaser for the rewards.
So why the Heart of Gilenor?
Well, Stone of Jazz, right?
What? It makes no sense that the Stone of Jazz has been there like all the time, right?
Well,
the whole time? Well, I mean, isn't it sort of, we just don't know where it was before? I mean,
ever
since. We didn't
know where it was before when Sliske stole it.
We knew because we saw it in Dishonor Among Thieves.
Yeah, but wasn't that through a flashback?
When we last knew.
I thought that
was a
flashback.
No, we actually tried stealing it in Dishonor.
Right,
Among
right.
Thieves.
Okay, because of the. Okay, here's why it was in the heart.
Because they had leftover assets from when they made God Watch Engine 2. Yeah.
Well, they could, but you guys also need to remember that there's an Elder God sleeping under the desert. That's where Jazz was in Heart of Stone.
Yeah. But why would you hide the Stone of Jazz with Jazz?
It doesn't seem like there's much thought put into that. I mean, I guess that could Sliske. No, it makes total sense. Remember at we need to jump ahead for this. But do we want to say what the end punchline of this quest was now or wait until after? Because I think it makes total sense when you think about it.
I think we could say it now and then just expound upon it later.
Okay, I don't want to say it now. I want to deal with the labyrinth, which is the big elephant in the room. I know that deeply distressed you, Sirion, from a game design perspective. So,
yes,
you have this labyrinth. It's this huge maze. You can only see a quarter of it, I think, at a time. That sound right?
And that only if you like figure out the new inventory system, window system, mm-hmm. and are able to sort of make the minimap take up most of your screen.
If you haven't done the quest yet and you're for some reason listening to this, when you do it, make your minimap massive.
No. Look up a map on the internet.
Yeah. No, don't do that.
All right, I'm going to be completely honest with you guys right here. I spent 20 minutes down in this maze, and I had already spent an hour on the quest, and I saw how large this was. I wasn't going to be caught running around a maze without a guide on the paths for hours, okay? And even following a path through the maze, not the puzzles. I did the puzzles on my own.
Yeah, same.
I spent 6 hours on this quest.
Even did part of the mazes on my own. It was just like sometimes when it wasn't obvious where to go, I looked at the map because I couldn't be bothered going exploring on my own.
Exactly.
There was just...
And here's where the game design perspective comes in, Sirion.
Let me be clear that having a maze is not a problem. The premise is all right, but then making it this huge just to make it harder, that was not great.
And not
then
to mention you need to do it twice.
I'm going to come to that in a bit. So then you can only, the only way to actually see a bigger part of the, the only way to see like a bigger part of the maze that's actually useful, you have to like fiddle with the inventory system. There's like 2 pixels you can use to resize the map. So that frustrated me. Then you can only see a quarter at most. Even if you have like huge draw distance on, that's not helpful at all. There's just no way where you know where to go. The only thing you can do is like explore and hope for the best. And that's worse than say... Morning's End Part 2 or Elemental Workshop 3, because at least like theoretically you can figure out what
there's
to do.
Logic and a path to a
there's
solution
logic
for
in, and this was just running around, and even like there was such a distance to cover in those mazes as well, and then to make it even harder they put in these weird stepping stones room because like the quest didn't take enough time. I can make this labyrinth more interesting, give me a whiteboard in 5 minutes and I give you a bad labyrinth. It's that simple.
Yeah.
Like, players doing this quest are high level. They're supposed to be really, really good adventurers. They have all their skills. There was no skilling in this quest at all. Wouldn't that have been interesting?
I don't know. Maybe the skill was the fact that it was just so expansive and so cryptic and so hard to actually decipher. I mean, that in and of itself does require at least some level of skill.
Oh yeah, but like there was a factor of like the navigational thing. That's fine, but at least give the player the information to do it like right. sure, there can be some chance in it, but like, don't have a player run around endlessly and don't give them all the information in the quest. Like, some of the puzzles, literally the hint was like, I'm not going to help you figure out this puzzle on your own.
Yeah,
like,
that was
what
stupid.
Am I supposed to do? I solved the puzzle by trying. Well, that's just not a fun experience.
Yeah, I believe and it was the second shadow puzzle, rotating the mirrors. I spent a good 45 minutes on that, just trying to figure it out.
I mean, there was also like the only elements from the other quests that came back were like the shadow puzzles from, that was the Barrow's quest. I don't know. Kindred Spirits, there you go. That was the only thing from which we saw some elements coming back. And I thought that was such a shame because we had so many good quests like that were part of this thing. And you would say that the final end game quest would sort of mash it all together and test you to your limits, but all you do is running around with a god that has turned to the dark, just aimlessly running behind you.
That was weird.
That was...
Did it have anything to do with anything?
No, it felt...
Like, there's an option to ask it if it has any advice, and I mean, I don't know why we're calling Ithlarin an it, but...
Well, it was a dog at that point, but like, okay, you can ask for advice, and it says woof. I mean...
Yeah. No, there were some points where it was lucid, and it was like, go toward the glowy stuff. Oh, thanks. Totally didn't know that.
That's almost more help, like less helpful than Sliska saying take a left here. Oh no, I was lying. Take a right. I mean,
yeah. So what would you do, Sirion, for making this labyrinth modern and not just exercise in clicking and pathfinding?
So I would not make two. First of all, like I clicked the exit, I was like, God, finally, I can like move on. And there was a second one. I almost just rage quit at that point. I was like, no, yeah. I'm not going to do a second one. But like in general, like give the player... Because did you feel smart for figuring out Labyrinth in the end?
No.
Not really.
So what you have to do with like puzzles like this is give the user the information to solve it, which involves not just randomly trying things, like give them steps they have to follow, put logic behind it, because then they feel smart when they finish it because they figured it out. Also, I felt there was so much more they could put in this maze except for like running around. Like they could have put puzzles in there that involved some skilling. They could have put some puzzles in there that maybe some light combat. Like the labyrinth kind of was like...
Well, there was some light combat. You needed to kind of like kill a white or two, right?
Yeah, that took me 2 seconds.
Yeah, okay, that's not a puzzle.
So, like, I mean, the thing I told you, right? When we first got all thrown into this maze, I was like, hey, this is a bit like the Hunger Games, right? Like, put all in a maze and the person who comes out first wins. That's fun. Because, like, in the Hunger Games, you have to, like, use your hunting skills and, like, not just kill each other, but also like stay alive. And as an adventurer, we have like an advantage on that because the gods, they just make things appear and they couldn't in this maze. So that would have been interesting. But instead, it's just running around. Like any imbecile can do that.
That's a strong word. And I think that summarizes precisely how you feel about this maze. And I think another thing that was lost on the maze and lost on the quest in total is that it took everyone so long to get through this that the rooms that were purple in border and the ones that had cutscenes in them prevented the timer from ticking down. And that would allow for, when you were in the maze, the clock was running against you and presumably everyone else. But if you were in one of these rooms, the timer would stand still. But there's so few of these rooms that the vast majority of time you're not in these rooms, so everyone else is proceeding through this. And from what we can tell, based on what the clan questers are saying, is that if you spend so much time in the maze, you're going to see Armadil in the final race. I assume you guys both saw Armadil in the final race.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Was there a chance of not seeing him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
what?
This is. Do you remember this big moment, this huge moment in Children of Mar, where Zaros asks Zamorak to do one thing for
just,
him?
Just wait. I just want to say that what you're about to say was the entire big deal of Children of Mar. Aside from,
so I missed this. Holy no! That was the whole thing, and we didn't even get it.
So there is a chance that if Zamorak comes out first, right, and you race against him, that is when Zaros asks Zamorak to do something. And that's the only way you could see the reveal of that huge, huge plot point in Children of Mar.
And is that only if you, like, finish it quickly?
I don't know. There must be some trigger to make Zamorak win. Nobody knows how, but, like, there is a very few people that I have, like...
I think we saw one on the Clan Quest forum, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so dumb.
Like, I was looking forward to this whole intrigue thing between Zamorak and Zaros. That was so cool.
Right?
I didn't even think about it. Oh, my gosh. Now I'm frustrated.
We're going to make you a little bit more frustrated right now. Mechanics-wise, there were some problems with the cutscenes in this quest. Sirion, explain.
So, during the cutscene, it was, like, not these fancy cutscenes. It's just, like, characters spawned in and the camera just set to fixed angles. For, like, at least half these angles, my camera was stuck in a wall.
Yep.
If you enter a purple room and you accidentally click anywhere at any time after you enter, then you miss the entire cutscene and cannot go back to re-trigger it. So don't.
I missed one of the Saren ones. I think it was Saren Zamorak.
I missed at least three.
Yep.
I missed one with Death. I missed one with Saren and Armadil, and I missed one with Armadil and Sarah Doman.
Oh gosh, that's way too many. That's way too many.
I'm really bad at misclicking, so that really came back to haunt me in this quest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, just you have to do extra stuff in the maze to get all the cutscenes out. And I don't think there's a lot of people that are very much looking forward to doing some extra time in the maze just to get the final cutscenes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this, I think, is the major, major detracting point from this quest. The cutscene issues, the maze itself, and the fact that we all spend so much time in the maze. We're getting an ending that we probably shouldn't have got based on our choices. So, I mean, if so many people are getting Armadil, then what does that say about where Armadil is on the picking point for finishing the maze?
Yeah. I never, ever sided with Armadil, even in the world event. So how did I get Armadil?
What I heard is that Armadil had, like, an advantage because two got kills, but I couldn't come up with a second one unless I am really missing something. So,
yeah.
But from what I like, gathered from different sources, that Armadil wins because, like, the extra advantages he has.
Well,
but I don't know what the advantage would be, except for he killed Bandos.
Well, here's the thing. Sliske was top on the scoreboard before this quest began, and then you also had a tie between Armadil, Virago, and then Death or Ikhlorin, depending on what you did in Nomad's Elegy. Saren also had a score of 3 in that quest, or in the God scoreboard. So, I mean, is it feasible that you could have seen one of these other ones who were higher on the scoreboard, perhaps?
I'd love to see Virago in a racing.
Yes.
That would be...
Or Brassica Prime, maybe. He was in this quest, but...
He took off, yeah.
Yeah, he did. Had no role whatsoever.
He was above it all.
I mean, I liked it, but also that didn't felt part of the quest.
He had no interest in the Carriage of 1,000 Truths.
Yeah, and at the end when you speak with Jazz, it's just like, oh, that's just a little cabbage. Who cares? It's nothing.
Wait, what?
That's what Jazz said when you ask about Brassica Prime.
You asked about Brassica Prime?
I did.
I did the worst one. I asked why, and I got because.
No. I asked who had what are the Elder Gods, and the answer was we are.
Oh, so they're all dumb answers.
All right, we'll get to this in just a bit. But anything else on the labyrinth before we hang ourselves here?
I got a pretty nasty glitch. After you get once you get to the stairs that lead up to the actual race between Armadyl or Zamorak or whoever the heck you get, I tried to go south from that room because you enter from the west, and I thought that there would be more stuff down there, and I could check a guide to see if there actually is, but I tried going down there, and once I hit the first little portal to get me to the next section of the maze, the lower quarter, I literally every time I tried this about 5 or 6 times relogging, I waited a day, but it would then put me in between two walls and I could not move, and I just had to log out. So I'm not sure if I missed stuff completely down there. The last cutscene I got was Armadyl caging a dragonkin, and that was it. So maybe I missed stuff.
That really like adds to like the experience that this quest felt unpolished. Like the camera angles were wrong. The cutscenes were like not like easily skippable. There's bugs of people. Like there were lots of reports of people being stuck in the walls.
Mm-hmm. Why weren't all of the cutscenes like the ones at the very end where you have to click escape to get rid of them? I don't understand why they can't make them more like that.
I would wager a guess that it's a technical thing, that anytime it involves your character and it could be potentially dynamic, they can't do that because those cutscenes that involve pressing escape seem as though they are in some ways pre-rendered.
That's true. Okay.
But. So, like, all in all, that felt like this quest had so many issues, and I can only guess that they really rushed this out just to get this out in 2016.
Right.
This is one of the... I feel that they didn't even have a QA, like a person who did not do the maze before play through it and ask that person, hey, do you think this is actually fun? Which you should do, but I think Jax might even have known that the maze was absolutely obnoxious, but they just didn't have time to fix it. That's also a possibility. Anyway, I feel there were a lot of concessions being done just to get this out.
I mean, we could look at the stream from yesterday with Raven and Shawnee and see how long it took them to move through the maze, unless they, you know, didn't use some kind of JMOD hacks.
I don't know how long they took.
They play through the entire quest?
Apparently.
Okay. But bear in mind, they know where to go probably by now, because this is I'm a developer myself. I know all the, fastest routes to do things, and in games it's the same thing. Like as soon as you make a game, after like doing it 100 times, you know where to go and you know where to click, so like it's not representative of what a player would experience.
Yep. And I mean, I think that this is putting a negative light on the quest, perhaps a bit unfairly, because everything is focusing towards this labyrinth, and it gets all overshadowed because it was such a huge part of the quest. Now,
it was the only real gameplay part of the quest. Like, the rest is just boss fights and running around, handing invites, and being laughed at by gods.
Yep. And, I mean, with that, it comes down to a design problem, unfortunately. I mean, anyone who thought that putting it together a huge labyrinth like this for however long was going to result in a positive questing experience that is so stale in the labyrinth, at least, I don't know how that can be accepted as a grandmaster quest. But
again, it's not the labyrinth that's the issue. Like, in general, if the labyrinth, what if the labyrinth would have been as much fun as, say, the behind the scenes bar?
Yeah.
From the Gower quest.
Right.
Because the Gower quest was mostly happening in the behind the scenes part with a bit before.
That's right.
So it can be done. It's just the labyrinth itself had no variation and was just too long of running around. And that is where I think that they should have added more gameplay into the labyrinth, add some skilling, add some fun stuff. Hell, even make it like a separate thing where you can't go in with any items and you have to make the actual gear for the final boss fight yourself.
That would have been interesting. Yeah.
So, I don't know. It felt like they didn't give enough thought to the actual labyrinth.
Yeah.
Sadly.
All right.
And the same thing comes back to the boss fights, which we're going to
move up to right now. But first, basically what happens, after you go up, you're in a race. We all raced Arbidil. Apparently you can race Zamorak. I don't know who else you can race in that. It's anyone's guess at this point. I mean, it could be Zaros, maybe. We could get a laugh and see Virago there. Who knows? But you race to the stone, and you get to the stone. And I don't know about you guys, but you guys, I assume we all got to the stone first, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Nope.
So when you got to the stone, the god was waiting for you.
Yeah, because I didn't know that those little orby things were little delay switches. I just tried to go, because I had no clue. And then I looked, and I was like, "Oh, he's already in front of me. I can't use those crap." Because he ran really freaking fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you make it there first, Sirion?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did as well.
But from what I gathered, it didn't matter a thing.
That's right, because after that, you get an unexpected guest swooping in on the stone, Karapak.
Not before Saras and Seven show up and start bickering again.
Yeah, I'm interested, because basically what they were doing is they were calling on some sort of alliance they'd made with Armadil in my thing, which... Huh? Were they calling upon an alliance they made with you?
No. They just showed up, and Sliska was like, "I, you should have gone out." And they were like, "We're too powerful to be thrown out of this maze." And I was like, okay.
Really? Okay, so how mine went down was basically Armadil got there first. Hold on, let me find this. They both basically, Zaros and Charon, they show up. Sliske is basically urging some sort of destruction. Both Zaros and Charon basically say, "Hey, Armadil, now's your chance to make good on your promise to me," or something like that. And yeah, Zaros calls him like Praetorius Featherulus. I don't even remember.
Yeah,
it was something
like
that had to do with his winged nature. and basically, Zaros is won out because it was a true oath or some weird technicality.
Oh, the same as with Zamorak then.
What?
Is it the same like oath that Zaros had with Zamorak?
I guess, but when did that happen with Armadil? That's why I was so confused.
They haven't really had
any
interactions, have they?
No. That's why I was so confused. I was like, this cutscene doesn't make any sense. And then it was like, Dragonkin, stone is gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that is the first big thing of this quest. The Dragonkin come in and the stone gets blown to bits.
Did the Dragonkin actually, like, so for me, the Dragonkin were involved in the quest before the maze already?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But we didn't think they were going to have a huge role in it. And in hindsight, it makes perfect sense because, you know, we did have the one-of-a-kind quest, and they were very concerned about the stone because, remember, they're the stone's keeper initially. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I mean, as soon as you see that and the fact Karapak is involved in this, I mean, I kind of had a premonition that something like this could happen. So, the moment that stone disappeared, it felt like, okay, so this thing was set up for some other reason, and Sliske obviously... I mean, do you think Sliske knew that... No, he probably didn't know that was going to happen. You guys think he knew that the stone would get blown up?
No, it certainly didn't seem like it afterward.
He was pretty mad.
Yeah, he was a little frustrated.
Yeah, and I mean, that has to have been, I guess, where this quest line was going. It just felt kind of like a quick and easy out rather than, you know, having to actually give the stone to someone. And in some ways then, oh, your choice really didn't matter who you're going to side with or who would have ultimately got the stone if the Dragonkin are just going to come in and blow it up.
And it have felt- I not said for months upon months that no one was going to get the stone in the end? Something was going to happen. There was going to be some sort of Deus Ex.
That's what we said when we predicted this. I think it might have been you and me that predicted this earlier this year.
Exactly. I don't want to say I told you so, but
this is precisely why I said that this quest named Sliske's Endgame is a lot like the Star Trek Voyager episode named Endgame.
I haven't seen it, and neither is Sirion, so only the true Star Trek fans will understand.
Exactly. All right, so after this, you guys ready to talk about the boss fight, the final boss fight?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So Sliske is obviously very mad, and this results in him sending his whites after you again. So the first wave, these are basically, I think, level 70 or level 80 whites that you need to kill. They go down really easy if you're using area of effect magic and area of effect EOC abilities. I think you guys probably found that as well, right? Okay.
I was just using a bow and not too many. The only area of effect ability I was really using was, I think it's Corruption Shot, and other than that, it was pretty easy.
I think I took out
Ricochet,
I think I took out a third of them with Tsunami, so that was fun. I used Blood Magic for this entire thing because area effect in nature, and it heals you, so that was good.
I switched to Blood Magic in stage two.
Okay, good. And stage two involves you fighting Linza, Nomad, and Grigorovic.
Oh.
Nomad, oh, once again.
First of all, Nomad. Then second of all, Grigorovic is the absolute most terrible, annoying boss that is out there right now. And then there's Linza, who just reflects some of your damage back, because apparently the boss fight was not hard enough already.
I took Nomad out first.
Yeah, I was about to ask. Sliske intimates after you kill the first one that killing one will make the rest stronger. So is there an actual methodology to going about killing these guys? Because I just wanted more of it.
I wanted to kill Linza first because, first of all, the damage reflecting, but also because she was just doing the most damage to me at that point. And then I took out Nomad because Nomad was getting more of his special attacks during the fight, and I haven't had enough of those. And to be honest, Grigorovic in the last stage was not that much of a pain. So
that's right.
I did Grigorovic, Nomad, Linza, and none of them. I mean, I got them all. In a half inventory of food, so it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, same.
Took me two thirds of an inventory, which was I ended up killing Grigorovic without any food left over, so it was really tight for me. And it took me four tries, I think, to actually get there. So I found the fight actually quite hard because there was a lot of damage coming in, and I didn't have the damage output to get them down quickly enough.
I went Nomad, Linza, and then Grigorovic. Main reason I targeted Nomad first was because, as I mentioned, this is the third time killing him previously in the quest. This was going to be time number four, and I was just sick of seeing him, so I took him out first.
Well, and he also had the bombs that he was putting everywhere, so that was kind of annoying.
Yeah. Didn't really have too much of a problem with Linza or Grigorovic. I felt that, aside from the bomb mechanic, this whole fight up till this point was kind of brain dead. And, I mean, you just basically DPS them down.
It was not easy. It's just they took out all the interesting mechanics of the bosses because doing them with all the bosses at the same time would not have been doable.
Yeah,
so they just pulled them out, and that ended up being doing lots of damage control on yourself, basically. That's all you were doing.
Yeah. I got arrogant, and I tried to start fighting Sliske with half an inventory of food, and that didn't go well.
So, really? I started with like a half inventory, and I made it like, I think, to wave two or three.
Well, yeah.
To help me get
Sliske is very doable if you like can avoid the attacks.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just got to run around.
The key for fighting Sliske is just not to not stay still. And the only problem I had with that is I was using Asphyxiate for one of my abilities, and you know, you need to stand still for that. So I would.
There were moments where you could stand still. Yeah. And moments where you couldn't. So it was like, I usually like after he did like the hands attack, I used Asphyxiate straight away just to get him down.
Yeah. And then each stage you're fighting Sliske, you either need to destroy the portal in the middle or jump up to the ledge and pull him down. And then the third one was, what was the third one?
Trying to enter one of the portals.
Right, enter a portal. Okay. And I mean, it was a relatively simple fight, and with that regard, I mean, I guess that's okay for a quest, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. I will say I did have a use finally for Supreme Overloads, so that was fun. I used those on the quest. But beyond that, it's just a simple fight of DPS, and then at the end, you have the great cutscene of killing Sliske.
You first get the stage where you have infinite adrenaline.
Oh, right, of course. World Guardian status activated.
Where does that come from? Where do we get the power to, like...
I don't care.
It was so out of, like, that... I mean, I guess, yes, it was satisfying, but also... That's not how World Guardian powers work. Like, so that's not how they have worked in the past ever. That felt so random.
Yeah, it was almost like our own kind of god mode. You know, the closest we came to that was Wellgothic Sleeps when we touched the Stone of Jazz, and even that wasn't as powerful. So.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sliske is finally dead. You get the epic cutscene, and you stab him with the Staff of Armadil. I think that this cutscene was perhaps the best part of the quest.
It was absolutely beautiful. I loved every second of it. Like, the animations felt very smooth. Like, it felt like there was an actual battle going on between Sliske and the player there. And that was so well done. I'm just not entirely sure where the Staff of Armadil came from all of a sudden, but...
Well, Sliske had it, presumably. And you stole it, and you basically overpowered him and then turned it around and thrust it into him, so... you know,
He stabbed you.
That's right.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. So that's a thing now.
Okay, implications of that. Can we, like...
You're right, there definitely should be some for that.
Well, because at the end, you hear like Sliske laughing after he's quote unquote dead. So is part of him like now attached to you?
You're possessed.
So what it looked like is that part of Sliske sort of went, because the staff is a Siphon, right?
Yeah.
So by stabbing him and by being stabbed yourself, you siphon part of like Sliske's soul or something into yourself, presumably. So we're now possessed by Sliske and slightly mad.
Okay.
And so post-quest dialogue with Rolomia in Draenor does actually reveal that when you ask, is Sliske really dead? She says, you should know that, adventurer.
Oh, gosh.
Or is that just her being delusional? I don't know, because it's...
Well, why would there be a Sliske laugh if he wasn't dead?
That felt so unnecessary as well. Like,
it was, they just had to throw in another twist, and it just, I think it took away from the resolution of the quest series. Yeah. I know that it's not
exactly
truly over, because
exactly,
spoiler, we meet an Elder God and we kind of have to do some stuff to prevent utter destruction, so that story isn't over, but I don't know. I think they could have left Sliske dead.
Yeah, and I mean, it kind of undermines the whole aspect of what we were ultimately aiming for with this quest. And, you know, before we get to, I think, where we're going next season, as you know, anybody who's watched TV series will know before, it's classic in the last 15 minutes of the last episode of the season, when that season has been resolved and you start moving on to the next season, that is introduced. 24 was classic for that. That's what this exactly felt like here. So, but before that, Sirion and I, you were talking about the Empyrean Citadel that, no point that, at all. It's not in the quest at all. What's to become of that now? That, I mean, that was in
that was, it was a really nice piece of like scenery that didn't come back at all. Like none of the locations we visited in the previous quest came back. It felt very detached. Say Kindred Spirits, right? We spent an entire quest to get in favor of the Barrows Brothers, and the only thing that happens is they don't attack you, and they're going to keep the whites away for like one of the stages in the boss fights.
Maybe this is, I think we've kind of come across a big actual detractor of what happens when we take a quest series and instead of stringing it out and making it feel a little bit dead at times over, say, a decade, as opposed to smushing it down and going, we have to have this quest out by then and we need to hurry this up, condense it to 3 or 4 years. I think that feeling of disconnectedness can sort of be chalked up to the fact that they really had to rush these. And so it didn't feel as organic in how each quest and story flowed from one to another. Whereas if we took a quest in a series, did that one quest, have a bit of time to kind of really simmer on it, and then maybe a few months later go back and say, now what from this quest should we use to then go forward in the storyline and to improve upon and to go from there, you know?
What is not helping is that these, like, some of these quests were made by different teams, because Children of Ma and Sliske's Endgame, they're not made by the same. I don't believe they're made by the same.
Children of Ma was the Watch, and
Endgame was the Dukes.
It was Raven. So.
So that's like, see, that's different teams. That's not helping either. Like, there's not one mod that, like, is involved in, like,
well, exactly. And that's the thing, is that when you're rushing them like they are, they have to employ different teams to get them basically get different quests that are sequentially one after another being produced all at the same time. So they don't feel like they're actually spiritual successors. They feel like they're side by side more so.
I mean, it can be done in this way, but then you need a really strong creative director on these quests.
Mod Osborne.
There has to be a strong link, yeah.
Yes,
and that wasn't present.
Mod Osborne is like not really just a lore person anymore. I was just like main content.
And that could be part of the problem, because remember when this whole thing started, he was the main lore person.
Yeah. So, yeah. Definitely not great. I mean, I don't know if either of you are like, know anything about Doctor Who, but at some point the note I made during the quest was like that Jagex is bringing back more characters in this quest than Moffat ever did in Doctor Who. So there you go. For the Doctor Who fans out there, they probably know what I'm talking about.
And you see, I didn't want to be having this discussion about this quest, because this was supposed to be the quest that would tie off 4 years of RuneScape and kick us off into 2017 for whatever was coming. But it does seem like there's major problems about this. And if it wasn't for the deep lore behind this quest and some of the stuff revealed in it, this quest would really probably only be a 2 out of 5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or maybe even a 1. Because if you break it down into its core components, it is effectively a bottle quest, because everywhere you go in the first half of sending the invites is already in game. The heart is already in game. It could, the assumption could be made that this labyrinth was in the heart, you know, in the Telos area or below it even. So bottle quest. And then the final boss fight stage, well, that's just a stage and that's really simple to create. So
there were not like any interesting mechanics, like puzzle mechanics were reused from like the past quests, like assets. There were not a lot of new assets in here either. So you're right. It had bottle quest quality. It did not deserve to be hyped up the way it did.
Yep. And I mean, with that, they kind of had to because it was their big storyline that resulted in killing Guthix. And I think in some ways, the killing of Guthix was indeed a grander thing than the climax of this quest.
Mm, that's very true.
And when if you start off intro, so strong, you got to finish as strong or stronger.
Yeah. So let's then talk about the climax of this quest.
Right. And I don't know. You could argue yes or no that this is perhaps stronger than the killing of Guthix, but after this, and I think the reason it all makes sense that it's in the desert is because, remember, in Heart of Stone, Jazz is napping in the desert. Underneath Sophonim and that general southeastern area of the desert.
It was the ruins of Ulek, yeah.
Yeah, but that's geographically close enough to the heart, right? And we know elder gods are massive. So I think that's why it makes sense that this was set in the desert, as I was saying previously. And then the huge reveal from this quest is that Sliskay wasn't doing this on his own. He was instructed to do this by Jazz.
Dun, dun, dun.
Mm-hmm.
So was I surprised? Yes.
Yes, I was surprised about that.
No.
No.
My reaction was like, oh gosh, the Elder Scrolls card again? That was a bit my reaction.
Well, like, I mean, in some ways it's kind of to be expected, right? Because I think I also did predict this, that an Elder God could come in and totally influence the end of the quest, and we would have a Deus Ex moment, which is exactly what happened in this quest.
Deus Ex Machina, yeah.
I would love for somebody to go back into the previous quests or the previous updates of all this year and find that exact clip and see if I'm right on that. But this is where we're going in 2017, evidently, the Elder God's quest line. There's some interesting dialogue here between Zaros and Jazz, and it's just a flat out no. No, Zaros, you're not allowed to become an Elder God.
No. I demand my birthright. No. I did love how they handled Jazz's dialogue. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that is how an elder god would speak, because they're not necessarily familiar with what it is to be corporeal. So it's good that they're so brief like that.
The elder gods make me think of the prophets from Star Trek.
Yes, from Deep Space Nine. You're right. And I had the exact same thought as well. So I'm glad we're on the same wavelength there. Basically what this is, the prophets are the god of the Bajoran people in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And they live in what's called the Celestial Temple, but to all the corporeal people, that is a wormhole from the Alpha Quadrant to the Gamma Quadrant. About a huge distance of space covered. Thank you, Sirion, for letting us slip that in.
My pleasure.
Oh, my.
See, we could do an entire podcast on Star Trek. But
oh, I know you could. And trust me, back when Trekkie was the co-host, you guys practically did.
So, after Zaros is told no, he leaves. Saren leaves right after that. And then you have some one-on-one time with Jazz. Now, you get to ask the thoughts of the other gods, and you can choose one. And you can also ask one question. So my question I asked was why? And the simple answer, because.
Mm-hmm. Same.
I asked, what are the elder gods? And the answer was, we are.
Yep.
And
then I asked about Brassica Prime, because you could ask about one of those, and the answer was basically, it's a cabbage, it's nothing. So I got a good laugh out of that, because nice. I know how many Brassica fans we've got. And, you know, I think that going through this quest again, and some of the discussion lines that you can have with Jazz will be interesting. I would love to see what all the options are for this. Though I don't think we'll get too much. And I think that what this quest was ultimately set out to do was show that Sliskay was indeed the pawn of Jazz here and the Elder Gods, in that they want to destroy the world, and they have said that they have destroyed everything and started fresh, and that seems like they're the path that we're going on, right?
Mm.
And ultimately, it is going to be our job to convince them that we have a right to exist and we shouldn't be allowed to be destroyed. And in some ways, this is much like the Star Trek episode Encounter at Farpoint, the opening of The Next Generation, because Q puts humanity on a similar trial.
It's also like a bit like The Matrix, where it's like the cycle and
yeah.
the large attack. Like,
so,
no, I don't want to spoil The Matrix too much. But
I think everyone's seen The Matrix at this point except for Earth. So, but okay, so knowing that Sliskay was behind this, the whole thing from Guthix to here, and why he seems so psychotic at points is because he just had the end goal of destabilizing things and bringing people to this confrontation of the Elder Gods. So with that being said, everything else in this quest was effectively a red herring, question mark? Or in the quest line, perhaps?
I guess.
So, what I'm not sure about, so this sets up like a whole new, I don't know, a whole new quest line, right?
Yeah.
But this new quest line, because like there's a lot of things that are going to be done with this knowledge, that all that content is going to be locked behind this quest. This quest is locked by basically all the other quests.
They might start fresh again like they did with the World Wakes.
Please no. I still hate them for what they did with the fifth and the sixth age.
Well, I mean, they probably won't switch the age because, I mean, it's been less than a year, so. But I don't know, and that's why I think it turned, I don't know if this would, if you would call this a Deus Ex moment, because it turns out that we're dealing with Elder Gods rather than Sliskay's game. So that's where we're at with this. And, you know, I don't particularly know what this is going to lead to, but it just feels like, okay, so we were going for this the entire way, and Sliskay did know what he was doing, and he wasn't insane.
So.
It is kind of a letdown.
And I think you can tell that we're all kind of speechless here right now because we don't know what to say after ending this quest. It's like, okay, that's it. That's what we're aiming for.
I wanted to like this quest very, very much, but the holiday event component of this update was better than the quest.
I can't say that I disliked this quest whole cloth. I think looking deeper
I'm gonna agree
into
with you.
The lore and how they missed so many opportunities, how it didn't line up as well as it really should have. I think they missed a lot. I think there are a lot of errors. I do think there were some good elements.
Yes,
I don't think this
definitely.
Was anything what they wanted this quest to be. And I definitely don't think the reception was anything they wanted it to be. But it is what it is, and it stands as a quest. I think it's decent.
Like, it's not downright horrible. I think if you strip the ugly mechanics of the labyrinth out and put something else in there and maybe made it, you know, a 45-minute quest...
Strip all of the quest out.
Well,
and then...
I mean, find a way to put the dialogue in elsewhere and do that. You would have a good quest.
Yeah.
But the labyrinth just killed it.
It did.
Like, this is a 1 out of 5 on mechanics and probably a 3 or 4 on lore, I'd say. Would you guys agree with that?
No, I'm right there with you.
Okay.
So I spent, like, I think an hour distributing invites because I was going to all the dialogue options and I was really enjoying it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Really a lot of fun. Thanks. And then, like, I went to the heart of Gilenor and I was like, okay, I don't know why, but fine. Oh, there's Nomad again. That was a bit disappointing. And then I lost my mind in the labyrinth. So it, like... Yes, there were great moments in there. Like, I really enjoyed the lore parts, but... Well, some of the lore parts, at least. But...
Yeah.
I would have preferred if Jagex had postponed this quest for a few months and really gave it all the love it deserves.
Yeah, and
it nobody's gonna feel good about how this quest ended up being. Not the questers, not the people who don't like quests to start with, not Jagex.
Yeah, and why do you release a Grandmaster quest on the same week as a Christmas update that takes players back to one of the favorite Christmas events of all time? The week before Christmas, why do you release the Grandmaster quest that week, right?
Because it had to be come out in 2016, because that's what they promised on RuneFest.
Well, I don't know. I'm done discussing this. I think we got the core out, and then maybe we'll pick some more lore tidbits up in the replays when that comes in January. But
yeah.
I'm finished here.
When you come out of the Elder Gods, do you also have like a conversation with? I had a conversation with Seven, but that felt oddly specific. So I was wondering if that maybe is customized by player.
Huh. No, I don't.
At
think
the very
I did.
End. Where you choose to reveal what you talked about with Jazz.
Yep.
Yeah, that, I had that too.
Okay, yeah. Right. Yes, that was there. And I revealed it.
Same.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. And then you speak with Ichlerin, and then it's off to Relomia in Draenor to explain what happened. And then you get one final... and you're dead. I mean, you're not dead. You're possessed. So
and Renoma is no longer possessed because she turns into like a very cheerful person all of a sudden. Or maybe she realized you were possessed and was really happy because she knows that.
All right. So. Anything else before we talk about the rewards?
Nope.
No. Yeah. It was...
Please, Jagex, never a labyrinth like that again.
I agree with that.
Not like that, please.
Yeah. All right, so for rewards, we got 3 quest points. Tiny Sliske bobblehead, 5 lamps worth 250,000 XP each and a skill of level 85 or higher, and jeez, a set of skilling items, a combined catalyst fragment that works for hunting, runecrafting, and farming. For hunting, it resets box traps. For runecrafting, it lowers the degrade rate of the pouches. And for farming, gives a chance to collect experience from dead herbs while farming in the form of shadow-infused herbs. So that was interesting. The Ring of Whispers buffs gathering skills by a little bit. And the Necklace of Shadows is the one that prevents the familiars while active, prevents the summoning points from running down. So, yeah.
I find the rewards really, really cool and interesting. Again, yeah, this is one of those moments where I think, like, hey, they really wanted invention to tie into quest rewards. Could have been done here. But,
yeah,
all right,
but,
I like
mean,
quest
high
rewards.
Level.
But then you get enough lamps to basically get you from level 98 to 99 in the skill.
I did not agree with that. I thought giving out this much XP was a horrible idea. I mean, 1.25 million XP?
You get great, great items that are reusable while skilling and really, really helpful. And then you get also this XP.
Yeah.
I mean, look back at the experience drop you get from Wild Gothic Sleeps. Wasn't that 400K? And back then, that was like, oh my goodness, this is an insane amount of XP, and we literally just got triple that.
Yep.
Like, no big deal.
My biggest concern about this is that people will do this quest for the XP and not necessarily the lore.
Oh, don't they always, though?
Yeah, and that's the problem. That's why I think it's a horrible idea to give that much XP out.
I'd agree with that.
But, I mean, maybe we are in the minority here as questers and lore people. I don't know. We could just be all very psychotic according to the rest of the RS community and the people who hang out on Reddit who think that everyone else is psychotic, but really they're the psychotic ones. But anyways.
That's Reddit.
Thank you. I agree. By the way, there's going to be a good segment on Reddit in this year's clip show. Don't miss it. That's coming out on New Year's Eve.
Oh, I look forward to it.
Yes.
That's going to be good.
All right. Anything else on Endgame, or can we talk about Christmas now?
Oh, please,
I like Christmas.
Yes. Okay. So this week is Frost World Part 2, releasing one more past Christmas event, the 2005 yes. Christmas event. I was hoping for 2006, but it was 2005.
2005 was one of my favorite events ever.
Me too. 05 and 06, definitely up there. For anyone who doesn't remember, 2005 was the event in which you are putting together marionettes and baubles in Diango's Christmas workshop. And in the previous event, you decorated a tree and handed out the marionettes. But here, well, Diango has gone possessed and is all concerned about profits and, you know, putting out some battle marionette that's going to generate huge amounts of GP as the next rare. So that's what's wrong here, and you basically need to go through this and figure it out and get in, build the enchanted marionette and basically convince him that that's not what it's about and he should return to his true ways. So
I love the messaging in this quest. Like
yeah,
it conveys so nicely what Christmas is about.
Exactly.
And also it takes this funny step towards like the past rares, because that is not what Jagex wanted from party ads when they came out. And then they turned into this super rare, super expensive thing. And this is sort of like taking a stab at that. Like, hey, that's not all he wanted. So I think this was amazing. I really enjoyed the messaging they put out there.
Yeah, me as well. And, you know, just seeing this area hopping with activity again was really a great thing, I think, to receive for a Christmas event. My only complaint about this is that you don't have the ability to receive the red, green, and blue marionettes from 05 if you previously didn't have them. You only get the battle marionette. So
I think I do have them. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that what they should have really focused on here was, you know, rather than only focusing, I think, on what it turned out to be for them, why not instead focus on all of the past Christmas events and, you know, not necessarily recreate all of them, but, you know, this would have been a great poll to run. Normally I don't champion the player power polls, but this would have been a great one to run, and I think 06 would have won, as well as the Lumbridge Crater, because those were very social events and everyone looks back at those as two great years of RuneScape. So they should have done that, and then made all the past holiday untradeable rares available, because there's so many people nowadays who haven't played back then, and also people who did play then that might have missed them. So
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about making all rewards available. It's also this little bit of a loyalty reward. Like, you were there back then. It makes you unique. It makes you feel good for like being that long in the game, and I don't know.
All right.
I can see why you want to make like things available, especially if people want to like collect it, just missed it. But on the other hand, it also has this "I was there" like element to it, and yeah. I think that's pretty cool.
And you know, they were going to do this. It was one of the first player power polls that was run, was past holiday events for loyalty points, but it never came around. So when I saw this, that's what this year's Christmas update was going to be. I kind of assumed that they might be going down some path of that, which they did in a way, but not fully. But you know, nonetheless, I think this was a great Christmas event, a great way of topping out what we had two weeks ago, was kind of, I don't know, I found the first part kind of iffy. What do you guys think?
Of the Christmas event? I definitely liked it.
I haven't completed it yet. Okay. I will on Christmas, I think.
All right.
I definitely think the second part was a lot better than the first part. Yeah. The first part was sort of like, especially like doing the Wizard's Tower again. I was like, I don't really want to do this again. It was like, all right to do one time. It's just, but definitely like putting like the marionette event in was a great way of doing
it.
Yeah,
it felt new, even though it was reused, because it had the messaging about Christmas and it had the messaging about rares. And I don't think you could go for a better thing than that. So well done, Jagex, on this. And, you know, the rewards for it were, I mean, you get a lodestone teleport animation and an emote relating to this. So that's pretty good. And also the 2007 stuff from 2 weeks ago that you get. So, I mean, there's definitely a reason to do this event, and I think that everyone will be happy, hopefully, with this. As with the previous week, my only regret is that the skilling areas, unfortunately, are instanced, which is disappointing. So, but
I'm not sure. The Marionette Factory did not seem to be instanced. When I guess I'm not a player there. But
oh, okay. Well, that's interesting then, because I didn't see it. Though it could have been when I was doing it. But all right, we'll have to go back and have a look at that then later at some point. So overall, great Christmas event this week. And are you guys serious in saying that this Christmas event was better than the quest?
I think so, from what I've played of it thus far.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say yes. I for what it is, definitely.
In terms of actual like enjoyment,
yes.
Okay. Well, I never thought we'd see the day that a holiday event is rated higher in terms of enjoyment.
And I'm a master quest cape holder. I think I, I love quests. So this isn't me hating on quests. It was just this one was painful because it was very mechanically involved, and the mechanics that were involved sucked. So.
All right. Well, I don't think I have anything else left to say about the Christmas event, unless you guys do. So we can probably move on to other things this week.
Mm-hmm.
All righty then. Ho, 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 indeed. So this week we have some things in the patch notes. Various bosses are now feeling festive and have dressed for the occasion. If I was a bosser, I'd be happy to go and see what was going on here. I don't think you can see Virago all the way, can you? Like, you can't see the top of Virago.
So I actually saw Virago wearing a little Santa hat during the quest. Also, when you go to Virago, like, the entry, when you talk to him, you only see the top part of it, so you actually can see the face.
Oh, neat. Okay. I wonder about the Queen Black Dragon, if there's anything on that, or Araxor, for example. That'll be a fun thing to go check between now and January 9th.
Some of the Gobies actually are also wearing Santa hats.
Gobies and raids. I still don't feel good about that.
just like the Gobi camp you walk by when you bank from the heart of Gileanor, which I did several times because I wasn't great at doing the quest boss, they're also wearing Santa hats.
All right. Well, there's a good sampling then. Players with the 15-year anniversary emote can now perform the 2015 variant. Okay. Okay.
The beach.
2015 on RuneScape. The beach. And Tuska. That's all we got for this emote.
Seriously?
Like, is that really all 2015 in RuneScape came down to?
I mean, trying to think what else did happen in 2015.
Well, I mean, I can think of lots of things for other years, but 2015 seems like a kind of a blank. Beneath Cursed Tides, just going through some of our update list, that was the quest. Oh, you didn't like the Tutorial Island quest?
Please.
I love that quest.
Please. No.
Slayer Month?
Oh, God.
With rap, with
no,
Camel Warriors and Rippers.
Ripper Demons.
No. Wyverns.
No, I hate those things.
All right.
They make me itch.
See, I'm already on October, and I'm really not pulling much out here. Call of the Ancestors? That was the Gobi quest?
Didn't we get raids in 2015?
Was that a bottle quest?
Yeah, it was.
That was our one bottle quest in the year of bottle quests.
We also got virtual leveling.
Okay.
Pristina's waterfall fishing. The Lord of Vampirium. You could have put that in.
Yeah, why was that not in there?
Lord of Vampirium was great. Let's see. The Light Within?
Another good quest.
Was, Rework of Fist of Guthix and Togglescape.
Meh.
Let's see. Big Cats and the World Wildlife Foundation. No. Raids. Tuska Event. Okay, that was there. But that's
Raids actually came out in 2015, right?
It did.
That's huge.
Heroes Welcome. I mean, like, you could have had V or
a Dragonkin. Thank you.
Yeah.
Like a dragonkin killing
Yakumaru. Adamant and Rune Dragons.
That was a pretty.
Oh, that was the first RuneLabs update.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Let's see. Patches.
2015 was the year of RuneLabs. That's why all the updates.
Oh gosh, that's why I was
the aquarium. The aquarium.
That's your gap explanation. It's the RuneLabs thing.
Oh, there you go. I'm already at April, and see, none of these are jumping out at you guys.
Nope.
Dimension of Disaster.
Dimension of Disaster, I loved. That one I will stand up for. That's one of my favorite of all time. That's my second favorite non-serious quest. All
right. Boss Practice Mode. Skill Cape Graphical Rework. Dishonor Among Thieves.
Oh, a good one.
So many great quests in 2015. That's why they're not here.
Yeah. That is weird that they weren't included.
Yeah. Demon Especially Flash Mobs. Dimension. Hattie and Skull, and that's it. So.
Well, Dimension of Disaster was the 200 quests, so that was a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, why that wasn't that's definitely included. Bigger than the beach and Tuska. So.
Yeah, given that those events sucked. Well, the beach was good, but Tuska was.
It was rigged from the very beginning.
Yep.
Anyways. And
looking back, because now we have the end game in sight, it meant nothing. Hooray!
Well, I think the Big Bird event meant more than this, right? Because.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Even Saradomin versus Amarak seemed to have made no difference.
Right, where was Saradomin in this quest? There was no Saradomin, really.
He was in a few cutscenes.
A few cutscenes, but no major role.
Mm-hmm.
Ay, ay, ay. Anyways, the invention category has been added to Treasure Hunter. Players will only receive invention from prizes from this category if you've unlocked the skill. If the skill is not yet unlocked, the prizes will be filled from the divination, crafting, and smithing categories if these skills are less than 80. Cost of silver jewelry has been lowered. As such, they can now be sold and alchemized. That's good. You got to keep this.
So what was the deal? I'm not entirely sure if I understand this patch now. Why does the cost of jewelry has to be lowered to be sold?
I'm not sure entirely, but my guess is that if you lower the cost on silver jewelry, it is something that is going to move better in the Grand Exchange, and because the word alchemized, I'm assuming people are buying them to elk. So, skill training dummies can now be converted at the same 3-2 rate as protein packs can. So if you have a bunch of ranged dummies that you don't need, you can convert them to other things should you want to. Still not sure how I feel about skill training dummies, but anyways. And then here's one for us folks of Clan Quest and other clans. Players must now enter their bank pin before leaving their clan, including if their clan has no citadel. So, that's what we got for the... good patch. But anything else in the patch notes that stuck out to you guys this week?
Not particularly to me.
Alrighty then.
Wasn't the... Oh, am I confusing it with last week? Wasn't something made available for free-to-play players? It must have been last week.
That might have been last week. I'm not
entirely
sure. Oh, no.
The Gowaian outfit is now available for free players.
Oh, that's good. And they're going to get it with one Treasure Hunter key a day? Anyways. Well, you guys ready to move on to our listener discussion topic for the week? It's just a discussion point, not a question. And it takes us back to the quest, and it's from Thieves. Thieves says, Hey guys, just a bit of a discussion point. Jazz asked us to prove ourselves worthy of living. Jazz firmly told Zaros that he cannot become an elder god. And I'm unsure if it's just me, but at least 60% of the cutscenes involved Armadil, who expressed his desire for peace. Considering the amount of screen time that Armadil received, do you think he will be key in influencing Jazz that there can be peace and by extension leaving us worthy of Gilanor? Number two, do you think Zaro's desperation for power will lead him to becoming a future antagonist? And three, has this quest shifted your allegiances to any of the gods? And some brief quest thoughts are included. One of the most interesting things I've ever experienced, lore-wise, without the maze, it was generally a lot of fun. And with the maze, easily one of the least enjoyable pieces of content I've ever had the displeasure of playing in any game. Thanks.
It was great, other than this terrible, terrible thing that took up three quarters of the quest. I can't get beyond that. All right, can we give our input on one?
Please do.
Okay. Regarding Armadil. Okay. First, I think you're presupposing that us being worthy of Gilanor is contingent upon our ability to be peaceful, whereas I took it more of just that we are worthy of life. So I don't know. I do agree that it was strange that Armadil got so much screen time. It was, if it wasn't focused on Sliske, I would have seen this almost as an Armadil quest, because it had so almost every cutscene was focused on Armadil and someone else, or Armadil just himself. Most people get Armadil chasing him or racing him at the end.
That's assumed, though, because of time, and all the players took so long to get through it.
I guess, but they had to have known that.
We need to ask whoever it was that had Zamorak in their final race, or any of the other ones in their final race, if Armadil got so much screen time.
Regardless, I don't know. I really hope they don't, because to me, Armadil's kind of boring in comparison to the rest. He's kind of one note.
Well, to be fair, he hasn't been fleshed out totally. He hasn't had a Dishonor Among Thieves type quest to define his character.
I think we know him.
It's a bird.
He is for justice and a peace, and that's it. That's what I mean. In all the dialogue, we get a lot of dialogue with him this quest. We get a lot of time to really understand what his goals are in this, what his pursuits are, why he goes after what he goes after, and it really gives us sort of a one-dimensional, he's a good dude who just wants to do the right thing.
Yeah,
that kind of, he just seems naive. He seems, I personally would pan him as boring.
I was actually planning on jumping on the Armadil bandwagon before this quest.
That's fine.
Yeah, and you know, maybe we might start the next Zaros hipster thing.
Maybe, but to answer the question, I don't. He might be, but that's not the implication that I got from his screen time. I don't think he'll be super duper involved. I think
all the gods that we saw in this quest are going to be key in influencing us, just that there can be peace.
The only one who won't will be Zaros, and that leads into Thieves' second question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Because if Zaros can't become an elder god, he has to find some other way to make that happen. And, you know, I don't think he would be immune to the entire thing if everything was destroyed, so...
Well, what his goal now is to create life, purely create life. And I don't know how he's planning on doing that.
Well, he could turn into a corporeal form and hook up with someone.
That's not really creating life from nothing, though, because the life is still within you, and you're, if you want to get to that biological level.
Godlike, then. All right, fair enough.
So to create something out of nothing, yeah, I don't know. I could see him being an antagonist.
He might go.
You gotta just remember the concept art shown at RuneFest with the Elder God stuff. Zaros is in there, and it looks like it's him versus the Elder Gods if you look back at it now, which is entirely possible the way we're going.
He might go after like the remaining Elder God artifacts to like try using those, the power of those to actually like become
ascend.
At least
isn't there some rule that prevents the elder artifacts from allowing someone to become an elder god? It can only increase their power, right?
I would think so. I mean, how can the creation empower something more than the creator?
Right.
You know.
I guess we'll find out. I think the other elder artifacts are going to play an important role in like what Zaros is going to do from now on. I think the elder artifacts, except like if you discount the gods, they're probably the closest you can get to like the power of an elder god.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I mean, another thing,
like there was a reason that the gods were after the Stone of Jazz, so
I think the Stone of Jazz is perhaps one of the more powerful elder artifacts, unless they're all equally powerful. I'm not 100% sure on that. But that leads to another thing I was thinking throughout this quest, and I didn't mention earlier, the godhood tiers, and like, where are we at with that after this quest? Did that influence anything at all, or was there no point to that in this quest?
I didn't think like we saw any power changes here. Like there was no actual fighting between the gods, at least not in my playthrough.
Yeah. All right. And has the quest shifted your allegiances to any gods, assuming that we all assume that Zaros is potentially going to become an antagonist? I think that's the way it's going, and it seems that way. But
so the way I play my character is like I'm really, really careful of all the gods. Like I don't really trust them fully. I used to be sort of aligned with Saren, but like after what she did during Children of Mar, I just couldn't trust her fully anymore. So whenever like Sliska asks like who should get the stone, who do you think should get the stone, like the first thing I said was no one, but that wasn't an allowed answer, and I didn't trust any of the gods, so I sort of said that, well, then I'll take it myself.
Yeah, that was my option as well.
So, like, maybe not necessarily this quest, but, like, the entire run-up to this quest has sort of removed any allegiance to any of the gods, because each of the gods has, like, this little thing that makes me not trust them. Like, Zaros, I've supported the return of Zaros, yes, but I've always been very careful of him, and, like, Armadale? I don't know. He's too naive. Saren has this thing with Ma and only caring about the elves, and like each of the gods you can say something about. Like Saradome is just a prick. So yeah, and Zamorak is just
hold on. Zamorak is for the individual. He wants you to do what is best for you. See, he is my libertarian candidate, and that is why summer of 2016 or summer 2017, I believe you should vote Zamorak.
All right, that's fair. So, and you know, on that same vein, I felt that Armadale and what he said in his dialogue in this quest was the populist approach.
I don't know. So the reason that
like, just the way he was talking down to Sarah Doman.
What can be said about Zamorak is that he's not lying. He says what he admits like what was it, Liberty to Chaos or something? I don't know. I'm not a very, very good Zamorakian, but like he's true to what he says. And that's also what I liked a lot about Bandos. Like, yes, he was a warmonger, but at least he admitted it freely and believed that was the way to go. And that's what I like in gods. Gods that just are straight out, believe what they do. And the other gods just don't have that sincerity to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, either they didn't have it to begin with, or they lost it to their actions, like Saren did, for example.
Very thoughtful. Very thoughtful. And, you know, I think my allegiance to Zaros was gone before this quest, and I would probably, if I had to shift to something, shift to Armadil. So that's what I would go with. Thank you, Thieves, for that, and I think that your discussion point was great, and perhaps this is kind of where we'll be going in 2017. I think we'll learn more about this once we see the replays and what the other options were. Because if it comes down to the fact that we spent so much time in the maze that Armadil got all this screen time, that is something your discussion point number one kind of goes out the window in that case then, because it was just us to down to us spending so much time in the maze. But
I just hope the replay has a skip for the maze.
Oh, yeah. That would be great. Yeah, that'd be great.
Skip forward to next cutscene.
Alrighty, well, that does us over then for the questions in 2016. Back in 2017 for more of your guys' questions and discussion points. Let's move on to tech news. You guys ready for some of this fun stuff? I have a perfect way to end tech news for the year in just a few moments. But first, there's a story about Uber and a little accident, or I guess you could call it a bug, that one of Uber's self-driving cars had in San Francisco. So, one of Uber's self-driving cars in San Francisco was caught running a red light, and Uber blamed this on human error. So, they say it's essential that Uber takes the appropriate measures to ensure the safety of the public, the California DMV wrote to Uber on Wednesday. If Uber does not confirm immediately that it will stop its launch and seek a testing permit, the DMV will initiate legal action. So, the question is, were these cars being controlled by an automated driving unit, or was there actually a human at the wheel causing the problems? A video posted shows
the video.
Yeah. What do you guys think?
That is not a person running a red light. I think the camera was even mounted in a police car.
Yeah, it looks like
you're pretty stupid if you run a red light like that with a police car. It didn't look like somebody running a red light.
Yeah, you know, it does kind of look automated because the car has all these augmentations on it. And why would there be all these augmentations on the car if it wasn't self-driving, right?
I mean, maybe the self-driving part was turned off, right? Sure. But I don't think so. It just... There's also two instances of this on the same day happening. Like, this is the one recorded, but there was another one that was shared on social media.
Was that the bike lane one?
Might be, actually.
Yeah, Uber cars ignore bike lanes. But, see, this, but yeah, these are the kind of problems we're going to have to deal with when it comes to vehicle automation like that.
I think this actually happened, like, on the day of the introduction, didn't it?
Yeah, something
at
like that.
At least very soon after, yeah.
You don't hear about Google doing this because I think Google tested theirs very thoroughly before they put them out into the public. So
I mean, there were a few accidents, but like they were like relatively minor. They were explained nothing like this, basically.
Well, I mean, at least no one was hurt, and I think there needs to be full transparency on Uber's part, because anytime you're dealing with a technology like this that can effectively, you know, traverse traffic and potentially harm people, if you're not being fully transparent about it, then that vehicle has no right to be on the road. So
I think the problem here is that Uber never got a license to start running self-driving cars in California. Like,
yeah.
That is, they just started running them. And that's, when it comes to putting things on the road, that is a very, very irresponsible thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And then you get situations like these. This is just bad. I can almost not believe that they're doing this, but
it's kind of unbelievable that Uber would, but
yeah.
I mean, it's definitely something to watch out for, I guess, if you're crossing the road and need to see if there's any self-driving cars that are coming to get you.
I mean, there were tweets where, like, somebody was saying, this Uber car just ran a red light and almost hit my Lyft car. Lyft is like a competitor of Uber, if you don't know.
Right.
So this, like, it went right. It didn't go wrong, but it was really close to causing an accident. And that is really, really bad.
Yeah.
So...
Well, and I mean, it kind of shows why these kind of things should be tested at first. And I think before we go full automation, like some of these companies are trying to do, it's better to have human assisted, kind of the way that airplanes do, and that, you know, it can do the auto braking and stuff for you, but it's not going to completely drive the car itself. So
you mean like Teslas do generally?
Yes. Yes, that's right. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, that's something to watch out for. But as I said, I do have a piece of tech news that we can use to end 2016 off in style, just the way that we had the most fun with tech news on this podcast this year.
Oh, my.
So you guys will recall that we had numerous pieces of tech news about the exploding Galaxy Note 7s from Samsung that Sirion and I had so much fun discussing. Wasn't that right?
Oh, we totally lost it. That was so funny.
So, Samsung announced that they were going to be pushing an update to the Note 7s that would render them inoperable on December 19th and slowly roll out over the next month. And some people aren't really happy about this, that the fact Samsung is pushing an update to brick these phones in what really should be seen as a cause of public safety, because you don't want a Samsung Galaxy Note 7 that is operable that's going to be starting on fire. Like we talked about on One Tech News Story, it burned through the deck of a 737. That's how hot they burn. So Samsung really does have a right to terminate all these phones, and there are phone hacking groups that are fighting the Note 7 shutdown. So people on Facebook are banding together to work on software that will avoid the shutdown that Samsung is pushing. So basically, there's huge lists of people talking here on Facebook about how these phones are going to be shut down. And I mean, for example, one of them says, "Found you guys, and I'm hoping someone can help this non-tech guy through the process of reversing the 60% battery charge and blocking the upcoming brick update, please." So, I mean, wow. I don't know why people would do this. And someone even posted in this group here a picture of the Samsung Note 7 inside a stewing pot, as if they were going to use that as a way to contain the fire should it break out. Another one actually physically has the phone on ice. "It's water resistant for 30 minutes, so I charge mine underwater for 29 minutes at a time, remove from water for 1 minute to dry, and then back in for 29 more minutes. LOL, just kidding. Don't charge underwater. Bad things electrocution may happen." So, I mean, obviously they're having fun with this, and it is a well-known security threat, but Samsung did push the update to brick these phones. So I guess the question to you guys is, do you think Samsung should be bricking these phones because they're a public safety risk?
I don't know.
Sirion?
The only thing I do know is that I don't want them on my planes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the saga still continues, and I think Samsung will forever be remembered for this. And the fact people want to fight this, okay, that's very dangerous. So.
I remember talking about this first time. We were like, people are going to forget about this in like a few months, and it's still going, and it's so funny.
Oh, believe me, that's part of our objective here on the podcast, is that we're not going to let anyone ever forget about this.
It's literally been going on this show, at least, for about 9 months. It was right when I finished my quarter that it happened.
Yeah, it was Sirion's first tech news.
Yeah, our thing was the San Bernardino phone getting into by the FBI.
Right.
And then it became the Galaxy Note 7 stuff, and then it just went on for...
And then the Samsung laundry machine started exploding too. That was...
Oh my gosh. The irony of ironies.
It penetrated an interior wall of a garage. Lots of great stuff like that on the Clip Show this year, everyone, so be sure to tune into that on New Year's Eve. But if you have a Note 7, get rid of it. Or if you want to live dangerously, I guess you can fight the shutdown. Okay, last piece of tech news comes from Mark Zuckerberg. He has gone back to his coding roots and wrote an AI, a personal AI, in PHP, Python, and Objective-C, which are three programming languages, and now he's getting it voiced by Morgan Freeman, and this AI is going to be controlling his house. So, that is what Mark Zuckerberg made to the news this week, and the fact it's voiced by Morgan Freeman shows some interesting things about how he wants it to feel, I guess, godlike, and perhaps... as human as it could be, though I don't know how you could do that, because everyone knows Morgan Freeman, right? But didn't he voice God in some movie or something along the lines of that? I don't know.
Morgan Freeman played God in Bruce Almighty.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go then. But basically, the bot currently controls thermostats, makes toast for breakfast, and allows people into his home by recognizing their faces, which, of course, he tied into the Facebook API to recognize faces, right? So this is kind of a hint for him about where he would like Facebook to go in the future years, focusing in on AI and services like this that could be related to your Facebook friends, and then ultimately controlling appliances and whatnot in your house.
Do you think this is going to be like a competitor to Amazon Echo?
No,
and Google
no,
Home?
I don't think Facebook would market that, though I could be wrong. One example they give in this video is play us some good Nickelback songs. Then he says, I'm sorry, Mark. I'm afraid I can't do that. There are no good Nickelback songs. So
that sounds like a Google Home. Or an Amazon Echo.
Yeah, and that's basically what it is. He wrote his own to do that. And, you know, it's really interesting that he did it with PHP and Python, of all things.
Oh, gosh. All languages.
Like, those languages aren't the first thing you think of when you write AI, right, Sirion?
No. No, they are not.
It's like, okay, let's gouge our eyeballs out, why don't we? But basically, for anyone who's unaware, PHP and Python are... languages that really aren't, I want to say, accessible too much. They're not modern, and they're a pain to use unless you have the right toolkits. So, apparently this was part of his New Year's resolution to build a simple AI to run the home and help him with his work. So I guess that's what you do when you're the founder of Facebook. The hardest part was
money to burn through.
Yeah, that's right. And the hardest part was controlling appliances who weren't on the internet. So he basically had to get switches and whatnot. So I guess it proves that with enough hacking and with enough knowledge, you can write your own AI without resorting to a Google Home or an Amazon Echo or Tap. So,
did he use TensorFlow by any chance?
Did he use which?
TensorFlow.
I don't know what
TensorFlow is. The open source machine learning network.
I don't know. I have no idea. I'm sure you could look into it if you'd like. There was a more exhaustive technical post on his Facebook page. So, does this interest you at all, Colton? Would you like to control your house with an AI and have Morgan Freeman speak to you?
I wouldn't mind it. I think it would be funny.
Yeah.
But
you might as well just get a Google Home in that case then.
Yeah, it seems like a bit of a gimmick.
Yeah, it is, unless you have everything under full control.
Yeah,
what I talked about with like colleagues about these things is like it sounds cool, but also like because this is all Star Trek-y, right? Like computer this, and what people were saying is that like the whole talking to a computer thing to to interface with people was only like come up with, was only created because it makes for interesting television. It's not actually that useful. Like, yes, for like something it's more useful, but also in a lot of use cases it's just quicker to pick up a phone and quickly do it. So
that's right.
I don't know. I don't think this is ever going to take over our interaction and hobby.
Yeah, and I mean, if anything, I guess AI on its own would mainly be a way of enhancing reply backs from various services. So, not necessarily let's just do everything with voice. Though I guess you could if you wanted to, right? I mean, it's a form of accessibility.
Yes, like if you're like, if it's hard for you to get around because of like disabilities, yes, could be a great interface, but.
Yep. Alrighty, everyone, there's your tech news for 2016. Hopefully we have broadened your horizons and caught you up to date on all the exploding hardware that existed this year. So on to skill of the month we go. Definitely got an interesting dungeoneering skill of the month happening here. Flash is now once again in first place with 14.9 million XP gained. Mr. Bistro is in second with 10.5. And the RR Man is now in third place with 9.8 dungeoneering million XP gained. Then we have Undoer at 9.1. Then we drop all the way down to 3.4. Magebit, Parnassius at 3.3. And you, Colton, at 2.5.
Hey, I did something.
Yeah, and you're ahead of Jam Andy, which is to be expected because Jam Andy can't get any more XP.
So I was doing mine with dailies.
Oh, that's pretty good then.
Yeah.
That's insane XP for just dailies.
Thing is I have too many not 99 skills, so I ran out of challenges to reroll.
I see.
Vizwax is expensive.
Mm-hmm. All right. We do have a few achievements of the week this week. First up is Such XP Waste with 99 cooking on the 18th. Touchpad Pro got a great one, 120 farming on the 17th. Congratulations. I'm a big fan of that. Then we have Imperialis got 2, 99 Hunter on the 16th, and 99 Prayer on the 15th. Good job all around. Double good job to the 120 farming. I just had to put that out there. All right. So, pick of the week. Colton, you're up.
Yay. All right. So, probably a lot of you guys out there have heard about this because it was kind of a big deal because it's really one of the first big leaps for Nintendo into the mobile market, apart from their little Mi Tomo or whatever little social media thing that they released, and Pokemon Go, which is technically more Google than it is Nintendo. It's just sort of tangentially related. But anyhow, we got this week on Monday, I think it was, Super Mario Run for iOS. I think it'll be available for Android soon, and I think there's some sort of workaround, but it is not currently like technically available for Android, so sorry. But I think some people it is initially free, but you
okay.
Only
I was
get,
wondering about that because it did say free.
Yes, you get it. It says it's free, but let's be honest here, guys. It's a $10 game, and it's a demo that you get. It's a little demo where you get to play the first four levels, and it's fun. It's your traditional Mario. It's a platformer, but basically the take on it, or the change really is that instead of like controlling how Mario runs, he's constantly running, and so you have to. The only thing you really control is when he jumps, and the jumps are very just the way that they kind of mess with the physics of everything and how he interacts with his environment. It's very, very well done. And the timing is very reactive. It's very exact. And so you basically just become you are jump man in this, because all you're doing is jumping. But it's just your traditional Mario platformer, side scroller. But you basically have six worlds,
and four levels on each of these six worlds, and you complete each to save Princess Peach, blah, 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 every Mario game ever. There are, if you're more of a completionist, and then you just like to kind of get to know each level, there are three layers of coin journeys you can do for each of the 24 levels, and it starts with, like, I'm colorblind, so take this with a grain of salt. I think it's like pink, purple, and then black coins, and you have to find them, and they get harder as each coin challenge goes, and it's really, really interesting. It's the same, yet very different from any other Mario game that they've made. I think it's really unique. I think it's really fun. Honestly, I play it quite a bit. It's kind of become a joke between my wife and I that I'll like play it at the most random times, like during Christmas parties and things of that nature. But yeah, so it's a good time. If you want to do, if you are connected to the Nintendo network and you have like an account with Nintendo, then you can really take advantage of all the interactive stuff, because you can like find your friends and things of that nature. I think if you did Miitomo and all that, it would help because you're connected through all that. But you can do this thing called Toad Rally, which is basically you challenge another player online. You both go through sort of this pre-existing course that is kind of a loop, and you just go, you kind of do tricks and you get as many coins as you can, and if you win, you collect toads and you basically rebuild your kingdom, and it almost becomes like this weird kingdom builder thing, where you are, all the coins that you're gathering in your missions and all the toads you're getting from the toad rallies add up to help build your kingdom that you get to see and benefit from. You get to unlock some other playable characters. There's Yoshi, there's Luigi, there's Toad. If you end up collecting enough and building enough, you can end up playing worlds with them. So there's hours and hours and hours of content. And I think a lot of people were put off by the $10 price tag that they didn't really advertise.
It certainly looks like, that oh, way on the reviews. Game, it's guys. Got lots of one-star reviews because of that.
Which I don't... Come on, guys. I know it's $10, and that's expensive for an iPhone game, but think about it. This game is DS quality, easily.
And in some ways, it's going to be Nintendo's next strategy to remain relevant.
Oh, yeah. It's extremely mobile. It's extremely interactive. It's unique. There's a lot of gameplay. There are at least 30 hours of gameplay here. And
I mean, the problem you have is like the phone market is very different from like the handheld market. Like mobile games are really, really cheap in general. So Nintendo really has to work their way. Like they might be, I mean, the price might be fair, but they have to sell it to the users, and the users are like, oh, I could get this game for like $10, or I could get this other game for like $2. I mean,
it has so much less. I don't know. I take it from the perspective that this is, you have to come at it not thinking that this is Candy Crush. You have to come at it thinking this is Mario, and this is me buying a Mario game. And where do I usually buy a Mario game? On a Nintendo platform. This is not a Nintendo platform, and I'm still paying at most half the price of what I'd pay for it on a Nintendo platform. So I'm not too fussed about a $10 price tag if I'm getting enough fulfillment out of it. I mean, I think it does what it is designed to do. People are free to disagree, and then to that I say vote with your dollar. But in my opinion, it is worth the $10 price tag, and I think it's going to do just fine.
I think the challenge that Nintendo is really facing here is that they have to break into the market. They have to, like, I mean, the price might be justified. They have to sell, like, to the customer, like, look, this is what you would get on a handheld with, like, half the price. And this move into a new market is something that is very, very new. So I think that is what is causing the lashback, and we'll see how this game ends up being doing. And maybe this strategy will work out for Nintendo. Maybe it won't at all. I guess we'll have to find out.
Yeah. And I am kind of high on Nintendo. I'm a Nintendo fanboy. That's always been my platform of choice, and I'm super looking forward to the Switch. So maybe I'm looking through all this with rose-tinted glasses, but I've enjoyed the game, and I think if you are a big Mario fan, you enjoy classic Nintendo games, I think this is a game that, I mean, at least try the demo. The demo's free. At least check that out. So that would be my
record. The big problem I have with this game is, like, the whole obsession with Nintendo to protect it and all the DRM stuff. Like, one of the problems is, like, Super Mario Run, you have to be online at the start of the game to actually be able to play it. And
yeah,
I mean, this might require me to switch, like, perspectives on this, but when I play mobile games, I play that when I don't have anything else to do. Maybe, like, most of the case, that will be good because I don't have internet.
Right.
So,
and also, like, another very popular mobile game, Pokemon Go, had the same online requirement.
Yeah, but that is something you play, like, when going out and stuff.
Yeah, you're using GPS and all that kind of stuff.
This is more like one of those runner games, and that's something, like, that I would play on a plane or something, but I can't. And from what I've heard, this is also the reason it's not out on Android yet, because they feel that the Android version is easy to extract and to then redistribute illegally, and that's why they're, like, sort of building in more DRM before they put it on Android. And this whole obsession,
it's Nintendo trying to operate in the App Store world. It's kind of the same thing that you would get when you would put a legacy music company trying to operate in the online
Nintendo
iTunes world.
Nintendo also still has not figured out, like, YouTube video rights and that kind of stuff. It's, in that respect, a very old company, and that is, I think, what is going to make this transition to mobile games a lot harder for Nintendo.
I guess I understand. I guess I'm not the average user in that case, and I do agree that I think the whole must be online feature is something they may need to get over in the future if they really want to compete. So I understand what you mean.
Yeah. And plus, I mean, this was indeed also a hallmark for iOS, because I was to be iOS exclusive for just a bit. They actually talked about this at WWDC back in the summer. So they did do a bit of this to show off iPhone hardware too, aside from the DRM stuff. But anyways, looks like an interesting pick. I might give the demo a try, because I did play these back in the day on the N64, Super Nintendo, and all that other fun stuff along the way. Alrighty. So, we've taken up enough time of the listeners with a quest that, well, I mean, you know how we thought about that, and I won't say any more on
that.
What have we been up to? What you been up to this week on RS, Sirion?
Running around in a maze, trying to get the quest on before this recording. That was most of my RuneScape week, actually. Also doing the Christmas event, and still trying to get my engineering invention up. It's the same thing, really. Still trying to get my invention up to 99. So that's my New Year's resolution.
Alrighty. How about you, Colton?
This week also was running around in a maze for quite a while. I also got 98 Hunter, 98 Fletching, 96 Divination, 96 Farming. So,
oh boy, you've been busy.
Yeah, reaching that max. I've got what? I think it's those four levels, and I'm at 97 Invention, and that's it.
Do you need a counseling session
engineering,
like Mr. Bistro had?
I don't know. I'm not actively trying to finish these. I'm letting it go. I'll max eventually, but it's not going to be of my own choosing.
Yeah. Alrighty then. As for me this week on RS, aside from maze running, I got 96 crafting. I, you know, just decided to use some of the protein stuff I had left over. So 96 crafting is fun. Can do the effigies now. I also did, in addition to the quest, the Christmas event, and some herb farming along the way. That reward, though, does actually provide a nice benefit when you're skilling, so that is one huge upside of this quest. But beyond that, used my lamps on construction, because, you know, construction is an expensive skill, so I got level 94 and 95 construction out of that. So that was a nice boost. That's what I chose to use it on. But that's about it for me this week. This is my second podcast of the week. Still going strong, so that's good. Clip show has already been done beforehand, temporarily, so unfortunately there will be no clips for from this episode in there. But I believe we've covered everything nicely. So, all right. Anything else before we go?
Not for me.
Colton?
Nope. I'm good, yeah. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Alrighty then. Well, we will see you next week for the RSBNB Update 2016 Clip Show. And as Colton said, this episode is being released a couple days before Christmas. So Merry Christmas to all of you podcast listeners out there. And may you have a very joyous time with your friends, family, and loved ones. We'll see you next week.
Merry Christmas and happy holidays.